Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." The word of the Lord.
How the heck is this poor sucker of a preacher going to pull a rabbit out of the hat this week? This summer, we're looking at Jesus' parables about the kingdom of God. Parables are short stories that pack a punch. And they're about everyday things and everyday situations. And then there's a twist, something unexpected. And so it's totally normal to be reading a parable and get near the end of the story and say, "What? That doesn't make any sense. Why did Jesus say that?" Jesus' parables are designed to throw us off balance, to get under our fingernails. After all, if they ended the way you expected them to end, you'd forget all about them before you even got home. But Jesus used parables to challenge our conventional wisdom, to upset our mental apple carts so that he can show us exactly how his scandalous kingdom works. And that's never more true than in the parable we just read. A manager is dishonest. His boss commends him. And then Jesus says, "Now pay attention, all you. Take note. You could really learn a thing or two from this scoundrel." What on earth is going on? When we were sketching out this series and deciding which parables to include, I was tempted to leave this one out. It's stymied me for 26 years, and frankly, it was a bit risky. But we decided to include it, and by about Tuesday afternoon this week, I was beginning to regret that choice. I had read several scholars' takes on this parable, and none of them agreed on what it meant. And then I stumbled upon a scholar named Kenneth Bailey, who was an expert in the social world of Jesus' day. Now, his take on the parable is somewhat controversial, but I found it persuasive, especially in light of what Luke seems to be doing in these chapters of his gospel. Of course, I could be wrong, but let's try it out. Let's dive in, and at the end, you could decide what you think. There was a rich man who had a manager. The manager was likely an estate administrator, a paid agent who managed the contracts that the rich man had with the farmers who rented his land. This employee would have had considerable authority when it came to managing these contracts. Well, someone accuses the manager of squandering his master's possessions, mismanaging his funds. That verb squander is rare in the New Testament, but it had just been used in the previous passage, the parable of the prodigal sons. There, the younger son asked his father for his share of the inheritance, and then he squandered it in wild living. And Bailey argues, and I agree, that the younger son in Luke 15 and this manager in Luke 16 are on parallel tracks. Both of them were entrusted with another person's resources, and both of them squandered what had been entrusted to them. Now notice that the manager was accused of squandering his master's wealth. It doesn't say he overcharged the tenants or anything like that. Now this is an important detail, because it suggests that whoever made the accusation was looking out for the master. People actually cared about him. He wasn't one of those aloof, exploitative, rich guys. He was someone that the community was rooting for, felt protective of. And the master's response to the accusation is remarkably restrained. He calls his employee in and says, "What's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager anymore." It's probably safe to say that there was ample evidence that he had mismanaged funds. Now, if you've ever been in a position like this, and I happen to know people who have, firing your employee is a nice start, but it's typically not where this ends. In Jesus' day, if someone had been cooking the books, mismanaging funds, they would have been arrested and imprisoned immediately. But that isn't what happens. The master just fires him. Instead of having him thrown in jail, he actually gives him time to get his accounts in order. Again, the landowner is showing incredible restraint and mercy given the situation. He could have been a lot more severe with his employee. So the manager loses his job. And meanwhile, he has this little window of time before he's completely out on his can. And just like the prodigal son who squandered his inheritance and hit rock bottom, the manager is caught in a crisis of his own making. He realizes that he's really in a tough spot. What shall I do? I wonder if you've ever been in a situation like this, if you've ever made a decision with consequences that you can't undo, or if you've burnt a bridge or betrayed someone's trust and suddenly the future that you were building disappears. Well, this manager is in a crisis. His resume is worthless. Who's going to hire him now? His reputation is shot, and he considers his options, and they aren't good. "I'm not strong enough to dig ditches," he says. "I'm too proud to beg." And then he has an epiphany. He has no future of his own making. His only hope now lies with his boss. And he knows one thing about his boss. He's merciful. After all, most bosses would have sent him to prison right away. So the manager decides to take an enormous gamble. He calls in his boss's tenants one at a time. Now, at this point, nobody knows that the manager has been fired. That's important. They assume that since he's still doing business for his master, everything he does must have been authorized by his master. So the first debtor he calls in owes the master 900 gallons of olive oil. That's how farmers paid their bills in those days, in crop, not cash. The manager says, "All right, let's take your bill and change it to 450. He reduces the farmer's debt by 50%. Now, we read that and think, "Oh, there he goes again. Cooking the books, mismanaging funds, squandering his master's wealth. That is criminal behavior." Maybe. Scholars disagree about exactly how these discounts worked. Some scholars think that the manager was sacrificing his commission. The total bill included the actual rent and the manager's commission. Others think that the master had to bear the entire burden of these discounts. We don't know for sure if it was one or the other or both. We just don't know. What we do know is that the tenants experienced these reductions as astonishing generosity. And, this is important, they assumed that the master had authorized them. And that, according to Bailey, is really the key insight into this parable. With just a few strokes of the pen, the manager has convinced the farmers of both his and his boss's obscene generosity. And now, instead of being derided for squandering his master's wealth, he's heralded for helping to bring economic relief to farmers. Now, what the manager does, reducing these debts, is obviously going to be well received by the farmers. The question is, how is his boss going to respond to all this? The manager is taking an enormous risk. It's a risk born of desperation. He was really out of options. And it was born of the hope that his master would continue to show him mercy. So it's the manager's last day of work. He brings the accounting books to his boss, who looks them over. And he realizes what the manager has done. And Jesus says the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. He doesn't say that he commended the manager for acting dishonestly. He said he commended the manager for acting shrewdly. Eugene Peterson told a story about a day when he went to visit a friend of his in the hospital in downtown Baltimore. He found a parking space on the street, went inside the hospital, spent an hour with his friend, and when he got back to his car, he realized that he had locked his keys inside the car. There they were, dangling from the ignition. And just then a boy about 10 years old walks by. "Something wrong, mister?" "Yeah, I locked my keys in the car." "Oh, I can help with that." And he pulls a piece of wire out of his shirt. And within 30 seconds, he's opened the door and is handing Peterson his keys. "Boy, am I glad you showed up as I was walking down the street," he said. "Is it worth a dollar to you? Are you kidding me?" This was many years ago. "It's worth $2. And he gave the kid the money and he gratefully got into his car. And then Peterson says that as he drove away, this parable, which had been puzzling him for so many years and had scandalized so many generations of readers, a crooked manager praised for an act of dishonesty, a rascal commended for being a rascal, suddenly made sense to him. "Wasn't that exactly what I just experienced?" he thought to himself. This streetwise boy of Baltimore's inner city at 10 years of age, already a pro at breaking into cars and asking for whatever he could pick up for spending money, using a dishonorable skill to stay alive in that bare bones environment, and now praised by me for employing his questionable expertise and prowess in creative survival. That's what Jesus means by shrewd. The landowner, the boss, at this point has two choices. He can reverse the discounts that the manager gave to the farmers, or he can absorb the cost. If he goes to his tenants now and says to them, "I'm sorry, that discount you got was not authorized. The manager has been fired, and your debts, I'm sorry to say, are what they were before he spoke with you." If he does that, there's a little bit of a problem. Right now, the whole village can't stop talking about how extraordinarily generous this guy is. If the master reverses the reductions, the hit to his reputation could be devastating. Now they'll accuse him of being stingy or a double dealer. All that honor he's gained will turn into shame. And in an honor-shame culture, that's about as steep a cost as a person could pay. The other option he has is to absorb the cost. To accept what his manager did and allow the unauthorized discounts to stand. Now, the manager has very shrewdly created a situation in which the master is essentially trapped by his own generosity, or at least his reputation for being generous. So the master has two choices. He can reverse the discounts or he can absorb the cost. If he reverses them, he destroys his reputation that he just gained for being generous. If he lets them stand, he absorbs an enormous loss. What does he do? He absorbs the cost. And then he commends the manager for being shrewd, for recognizing that his window is about to close, and then for using that window to secure his reputation, friends, and a future. Now, if someone put you in a bind like that, would you commend them? I don't know if I would. So why does he? Because the manager was right. The master is merciful. The manager took a huge risk. He gambled everything on his boss's mercy, and he won. He won big. Pretty shrewd. Now, the master doesn't say, "Wow, what an ethical person you are. What a bastion of integrity." He says, "You're shrewd. You're wise. You're perceptive." In other words, you get me. You understand me. You knew that I would be willing to absorb the cost. And when your back was against the wall, you acted decisively on that knowledge. You know, I was thinking about it. This manager is kind of the opposite of that servant from the parable we looked at last week. Remember the one who was entrusted with his master's money, but he was afraid of his master, so he wrapped it in a napkin and buried it? He didn't know his master. He was afraid of his master, and he did nothing. Whereas this rascal did know his master, and he risked it all. Haddon Robinson tells a story when he was the president of Denver Seminary, and the seminary needed a new phone system that wasn't in the budget. So he paid a visit to a wealthy donor, and he explained the situation to him, and the donor said, "Well, how much will this new phone system cost?" And Robinson said, $10,000. And the man took his checkbook out of his desk drawer. "And what do you want from me?" Robinson wasn't prepared for that question. $5,000. The man closed his checkbook, put it back in his drawer, and said, "You've either insulted my wealth or you've insulted my generosity. If you needed $10,000, you should have asked for $10,000. And Robinson left with nothing. And sometimes we're like that with God. We find ourselves in a desperate situation, but we stop short of asking God for what we really need. Because we don't really believe that he's generous or merciful. Every once in a while, someone will say to me, I don't think I'm saved. And I'll say, "Why do you think that?" And they'll say, I just don't think after all the horrible things that I've done throughout my life that God would want anything to do with me. And I say, you have no idea how merciful God is. I love that old hymn that says, could we with ink the oceans fill? And were the skies of parchment made? Were every stalk on earth a quill, and every person a scribe by trade? To write the love of God above would drain the oceans dry. Nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. The parable ends. Halfway through verse 8, Jesus steps out of the story and he says something really strange. He says that the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. He's challenging his disciples to be shrewd, to be wise, to be perceptive, and then to act decisively on what they know. The manager is a scoundrel. He's a rascal. But even he knows when he's in a desperate situation and can't save himself. Even he knows when he has to throw himself on the mercy of another. Do you? Even he understands that wealth is not for holding on to, it's for investing in friends, in the future. Do you? And remember, Luke puts this parable right on the heels of the parable of the prodigal sons. The younger son, the one who squandered his father's wealth and hit rock bottom, eventually comes to a realization. My only hope is that my father will be merciful. And the manager comes to the same realization. Both the son and the manager have squandered what was entrusted to them. Both are in crisis. Both throw themselves on the mercy of the one whose wealth they just squandered. And both discover that his mercy is real. This isn't a parable about how to weasel yourself out of a bind. It's not even a parable about how to use money, really. It's a parable about the mercy of God. The manager narrowly escapes a lifetime of self-serving calculation. In the end, he finds himself reveling in a spacious world of generosity and mercy. His life used to be defined by scheming, embezzling, cooking the books. Now it's defined by his boss's grace. The manager kind of reminds me of another scoundrel, Jacob. Jacob's name means to supplant, overreach. He lived up to his name for a long time, cheating his brother out of his inheritance, deceiving his father into giving him his brother's blessing. By the time he was a young man, he had burnt all of his bridges and fallen into the hands of a distant relative who took brutal advantage of him. And then one night when he was alone in the wilderness, he wrestled with God. And when morning came, Jacob said, I will not let go unless you bless me. He was throwing himself on the mercy of God for the first time in his life. And God did bless him and gave him a new name, Israel. Israel means one who wrestles with God and with people and overcomes. And that was a turning point in his life. The very next day, he threw himself upon his brother's mercy, and they were reconciled. But everything changed for Jacob when he met with God, the real God. Maybe that's what this strange little parable is inviting us to do. Not be shrewd or use your money well, but to know your master. know what he's really like. When the manager realizes that his cleverness can't save him, he bets everything on his master's mercy and discovers that it's real. It's enough. I wonder if some of us need to hear that today. Maybe you've squandered some things that God entrusted to you: money, opportunities, relationships, years. Maybe you've made choices with consequences you can't undo. Ever since, you've been living as though it's up to you to clean up your own mess, fix your own problem, rehabilitate your reputation, prove that you're still worthy, somehow save yourself. And along comes Jesus with this really weird story that seems to be saying your only hope has never been your ability to save yourself. Your only hope is the mercy of God. The younger son discovered it. The manager discovered it. Jacob discovered it. We discover it at the cross, where Jesus absorbed the cost of our failure onto himself. He took our sin, our shame, our debt into his body. He bore the cost of everything that we have squandered in our lives. So perhaps the shrewdest thing you can do today is not try harder to save yourself, but throw yourself upon the mercy of God. And then, having received God's mercy, let it flow through you to others. Stop white-knuckling what you have and start giving it away. Use what God has entrusted to you to create friendship. Practice hospitality and show mercy. Stop asking, what can I gain for myself? How can I work the system? And start asking, how can I use what God has entrusted to me to bless others? Because someday our window will close. Our stewardship will end. Our money and our opportunities will be gone. But God's mercy will remain. So be shrewd. Bank on the mercy of the Master. And when you do, all that energy that you used to spend trying to save yourself, secure yourself, and make a name for yourself can finally be spent on something better: helping others discover how generous your master really is. Let's close our eyes and take a moment first to just rest in God. Think of Jesus telling his disciples, I will show you how to take a real rest. I don't think he meant a rest from physical labor. I think he meant a rest from trying to save ourselves. Jesus, teach us how to take a real rest. We need rest. Your mercy allows us to rest. God, what else are you trying to say to us through your word this morning? What truth needs to take root in our hearts today? Speak to us, Lord. Your servants are listening. God, would you give us a little glimpse of what's possible? What would change in our lives if we actually lived as though this was true? Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and do not forget all his benefits, who forgives all our iniquity, who heals all our diseases, who redeems our life from the pit, who crowns us with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies us with good as long as we live, so that our youth is renewed like the eagles. Amen.